Can I get a beef taco, please?
Oh, we don't do that here, sir. Can I offer you our vegan gluten-free broccoli tacos with cashew cheese?
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
How about some chicken fajitas? Can I do chicken fajita?
No chicken fajitas either, sir. How about some crispy kale lettuce wrap?
A what wrap?
Crispy kale wrapped in lettuce with a side of vegan coleslaw.
So it's a salad wrapped in a salad with a side of salad.
I need to, you know, if I weren't doing this job, Cyrus, you know what I would love to do? And I'm being serious about this. I would love to operate a taco truck.
A taco truck. I was going to say, I would have said taco truck.
Yep. I would totally do it. I mean, I'm doing this, and this is what I want to do for the rest of my life, please God. But
I like tacos.
Hey, this is my first customer. Can you see me rolling up in my taco truck?
I would happily be your first customer, and I would say after I got my taco.
Now that's what I call a taco.
That's right. Maybe that's what I'll call the company. Now that's what I call a taco.
Where can I invest?
We'll talk.
All right, let's talk.
We'll talk. We'll talk over tacos. Let's see. Let's go to Joseph in Rancho. By the way, phone number. Sorry, Joseph. Hang on. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Welcome, Joseph, in Rancho Cordova, California. Oops. Let's see. Let's try it again. Start over, Joseph. Sorry.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my call, Patrick. And
sure.
I'd like to ask my question. What book can you recommend for, let's say, I would love to learn how to defend a faith against, for people who are highly intellectualized, rationalist, scientific, highly philosophical, PhD level type. Mm-hmm. How can I defend my faith against, or explain the faith to people who are non-believers of that level of, that level.
Mm-hmm. There are different ways to go about it. If you're looking for a good author who is really very effective at doing that, I would recommend Father Robert Spitzer. He's a prolific author. He writes for, a sophisticated, intelligent audience. He writes, not all the time, not all of his books deal with this, but he's appealing to, for example, scientifically minded atheists, for example.
Right.
And his material is very high level. I don't mean to say high level like it's inaccessible, but it's definitely written for the kind of person that you're describing. What do you think?
Father Robert Spitzer, I think, is this the blind priest, sir?
I believe he's legally blind. I mean, he has some sight, but yes, that's him. He's a Jesuit priest. He was formerly the president of Gonzaga University, I believe. But he's a prolific author. And I just got in the mail a review copy of his latest book, and I happen to have it right here. It's The Moral Wisdom of the Catholic Church, A Defense of Her Controversial Moral Teachings. And this is a tome. I think it must be... Oh, gosh, it must be every bit of 500 pages. I haven't started reading it yet, but it's yet another one of his contributions to high-level explanations of the faith. Very effective.
Wow. Okay, so I guess I'm going to guess I can go to Amazon, just type in Father Robert Spitzer and...
Yeah, I'm sure it's all there, yeah. I believe that Ignatius Press is his primary publisher. You know me, I'm a big believer in trying to support our local Catholic bookstores. I don't know if you have one where you are in California, but if you do, I would recommend going there first. Is Rancho Cordova is not far from Sacramento, is it?
No, sir. It is about 15 minutes away from the main downtown Sacramento.
Uh-huh. I thought so. Well, here's what I'd recommend then. I would recommend Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts because they're there in Sacramento. They've moved in recent years, but if you look them up, you'll find where they're located. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if they have tons of Father Robert Spitzer's books on the shelf there. And if they don't, they could order it for you.
Easter's. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Great talking to you, Joseph. Thank you. We'll go to Patricia now in Reno. All the way to Reno, as REM would say. Welcome, Patricia.
Yes. Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. My question is, my father, my elderly father, is 84. He has advanced dementia, is in the ICU with pneumonia and sepsis, and the doctors are talking about DNR and hospice, and he currently can't talk. He opens his eyes, but sometimes he's sleeping, so he's kind of conscious, but then sometimes not. And I'm wondering, can I baptize him at this time? He's not Catholic. I'm the only Catholic in my family.
Okay.
And
was he ever baptized?
Pardon me?
Was he ever baptized in any previous, let's say, Protestant church or anything?
No. He is actually, his father was Buddhist.
I see. Well, the answer is yes, you can. Now, under the circumstances, the ideal thing would be if you can have the parish priest come, and if there's some way to communicate with your father so that he could show that he desires baptism, that would be ideal. Dad, if you love God and you want to become Catholic, squeeze my hand, blink your eyes. I mean, I don't know if that's possible.
Well, I've tried to do that when he wasn't in the hospital and in critical condition, but he just can't talk. He just doesn't talk. He doesn't respond.
I understand. Now, when go ahead.
I think it's because he has advanced dementia, so I don't really know how conscious. I mean, he is aware. It's just he doesn't talk.
I understand. So that would be my advice then, Patricia. Try and see what happens when you're talking to him. Maybe his eyes are closed. Dad, if you can hear me talking to you, please squeeze my hand. And maybe he will. Dad, you know, it's time soon to go into the next life. And I want you to be happy with God. And Jesus loves you. He wants to save you. And I'd like to have you baptized. Is that okay with you? Do you love God? Are you sorry for your sins? Do you want to be baptized? Squeeze my hand. And maybe he'll do that.
If he doesn't do it, then what do I not baptize him?
Well, here's the next step. So my next question was going to be, in his lifetime before he slipped into dementia, did he ever express any kind of interest in Jesus? Did he express any interest in God as we understand him? Or did he ever, on the other side of things, did he ever like show that he was adamantly opposed to Christianity? Did he ever reject Jesus or say, no, I don't believe that? Or was it just sort of unspoken?
I think he's always been interested in spirituality. He was interested in Buddhism. But at the same time, I think he also, earlier in his life, he said he was an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
He was very... you know, like just very mental. In terms of Jesus, I think he was, you know, he went to mass with me once, but I think he wasn't really interested in Jesus because he never really asked about Jesus.
Right. So my advice. Did you want to add something more, Patricia?
Oh, I just was going to say, I think he was interested in spirituality, but I think he had difficulties. But he was growing interested and open generally to spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my advice would be, if you have at least some moral certitude that your dad never rejected Jesus or he never said, no, I don't want to be baptized, I don't believe in that, no. I mean, if he never expressed anything like that that you're aware of, and if he did in his own way, express a kind of openness, at least, even if he wasn't interested, at least he was open and he didn't reject it. What I would do if I were in your situation would be to ask your parish priest to come to the hospice place where your father is and baptize him and give him the sacrament. So if you baptize him first and give him the sacrament, here's why. Because it may be that now he's at this point of his life that he does have some desire to be forgiven for his sins. He does have a desire to believe in God, to follow Jesus. If there's enough implicit evidence that that may be there, that would be sufficient grounds to do so.
Well,
Well, I guess I just really, as I'm talking to you, but I just really don't know. You know,
well, that's what I'm saying, Patricia. Focus on this issue here. It sounds like you really can't know. You can't discern because there's no way for him to communicate with you. You can't tell one way or the other. He can't speak. So that's why I was suggesting try a workaround. Dad, if you can hear me speaking to you, please squeeze my hand. Maybe he will. Maybe you'll say, okay, well, he can communicate. He just can't speak. And then, Dad, your life is nearly over. I want you to be happy. Jesus loves you. He wants to forgive you of your sins. And we'd like to have you baptized so that you can receive God's forgiveness. Do you want to do that, Dad? Are you okay with that, Dad? And squeeze my hand. Now, maybe he will. So try it. You have got nothing to lose. And I would say try it more than once. See what happens. You got nothing to lose. But even if he doesn't do that, if in his life he had shown an openness and a willingness to, you know, understand the truth, even though he didn't really catch it, he didn't really show an interest in it, at least he was open to it. And that's why I was asking you earlier, if he had shown you that he rejected Jesus, then you shouldn't baptize him because he's rejecting it. He did not want what Jesus had to offer. But short of that, if he was at least open to the possibility, it may be that he's properly disposed, may well be that he's properly disposed to receive baptism. Now, what's interesting is that the effects of baptism will have that effect the way it does with a newborn baby who's baptized. The little baby doesn't have any capacity to communicate. He can't speak. He can't even squeeze your hand. If you said, if you understand what I'm saying, squeeze my hand, he can't do that because he doesn't have the mental capacity to understand it. And so he can't choose this little baby who's being baptized. He can't choose because he doesn't know. And yet the sacrament has this effect in his soul because it's the power of Jesus working. In the case of an adult who's above the age of reason, consent has to be there, or at the very least, a lack of rejection. So that's why if I were in your situation, I would call your parish priest, explain all this to him, and let him know that you have grounds to believe that your father would receive baptism and receive faith in Jesus if he were awake to do it, and Father, would you please baptize him? And then he can give him the other sacraments after baptism. That's the way I would handle it. Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, what if I don't really know, like, in his life before he got ill? I feel, like, torn, because I think at times he was not really, like, he was rejecting religion, but at other times he was more open. Hello?
Yeah, Patricia, I don't know how else I can say it. I mean, with all respect, I think I've answered that question. If you can't know, you can only go by what you do know. And if you do know that he at one time rejected faith in Jesus in some explicit manner, well, then I would assume that that would be his state of mind now, in which case probably would not want to baptize him. But short of that, if you have no recollection of him ever doing that, I would have him baptized. And, you know, the worst that could happen is in his mind, he's saying no, and the baptism doesn't have an effect on him. There's no way for you to know that. So given the circumstances, I think the smart thing to do, for him at least, would be to ask the priest to baptize him. Now, the reason I say that, and I'll leave it at this, is because it's always preferable for there to be a record of this baptism. And so that would be entered into the record with a baptismal certificate of the parish. It doesn't mean that in an extreme situation, so let's say he's dying right now, he's dying, and in another minute or two he will be dead, you can baptize him in the name of the Father and of the Son. You know, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit as you pour water over his head and say the words and intend to baptize him. So in extreme situations, you can do that. So I hope that brings you some help, Patricia, and we will pray for your father's peaceful and holy death, please God. Let's go to Jim now in Minnesota. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, two questions. Who said that the Blessed Virgin Mary said that the more souls in hell are because of immorality? Was that St. Faustina?
You know, Drew Mariani's an expert in the revelations given to St. Faustina, and I'd have to consult the Diary of Divine Mercy. I think that that may be in there, but I know that Our Lady said this to the three children at Fatima. So in the place where she gave them the vision of hell, she did make that indication to them.
Okay. And then the last question, what would constitute giving your life for a person? My wife's coworker was actually taking care of her husband, who is going to need a double lung transplant and very sick. And the day that, day before she died, my wife talked to her, and she had double pneumonia. And my wife said, "You need to go in." She said, "No, I have to take care of him. He's had a bad day today." She said, "I have some pills." Well, he got up the next morning, and she was blue. She was dying. She died to taking care of him. We're so worried about him. Would that constitute that?
Does that constitute what?
Giving one's life for another person.
Well, if by that you mean laying down your life for somebody else, as Jesus said, "No greater love hath any man than to lay down his life for a friend," is that what you mean? Like, give your life in that sense?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think so, because she didn't. I mean, I think I'll put it this way. I don't mean to say no, but I don't think that's the more common meaning of this. But if she poured out her own life, so let's look at the yes part of it. She poured out her own life. She sacrificed herself and her own health by taking care of him. To that extent, I think we could say yes. You know, she laid down her life for her husband because she could have been seeking treatment. She could have been resting. She could have been doing other things for herself. But rather than look after herself, she was looking after him. So in that sense, yeah, I think so.
Yep, that sounds good to me. Now, she had a tough life, but hopefully it's a lot better for her.
Indeed. Well, she must have been a wonderful woman. Thanks, Jim. May she rest in peace. Let's see. If you want to be on the program, we have a line that just opened up. It's yours if you call 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
Now, Rose, at the time, had Taco Tuesday been invented yet?
I want to say it had.
Thank you. No further questions.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay. Boy, it's amazing to me how fast this program goes by. We have about 35 minutes to go. So let's go. Let's go to David in Miami. Hi, David.
Hello?
Yeah, welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Yeah, just want to get the Queen of Heaven. That phrase is only, I see it referring to demons and idols in the Bible, but the Catholic Church seems to have given that term to Mary, and I was wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, so there is reference to an idol, and this is in Jeremiah chapter 44, for example, where we see the phrase Queen of Heaven, and that was a name that was given to an idol, a non-existent being, so either a demon or at least just a fake entity who didn't really exist. There's only a superficial connection at best. The fact that we give Mary the title Queen of Heaven is actually seen in the Bible itself in Revelation chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, where St. John says, "Then I beheld a great sign in the sky, a woman clothed with the sun, and on her head a crown of 12 stars standing on the moon." So the child that this woman was wailing aloud in labor to give birth to is Jesus. So the literal meaning of Revelation chapter 1 and following, chapter 12, verse 1 and following, the literal man there is being spoken of is Jesus. So the literal meaning of the woman is Mary. That doesn't preclude other meanings. But there we see Mary with a crown in heaven. And so the church's affectionate term for her as Queen of Heaven is based upon that biblical allusion there. We also see that just before that verse, verse 1, we see at the very end of chapter 11, the St. John says that he saw the Ark of the Covenant in the sanctuary in heaven, and he talks about a great earthquake and peals of thunder and lightning and a great hailstorm. And then he says, I saw a great sign in the sky, a woman clothed with the sun. So that connection between the Ark of the Covenant, which is an Old Testament reality that prefigured the Blessed Virgin Mary, we see that juxtaposed immediately alongside this reference to her as wearing a crown and being in heaven. And she's wearing resplendent garments. She's wearing royal garments, clothed with the sun, etc. So she's clearly a queen. And so for the church to recognize this biblical truth and to refer to her as the Queen of Heaven in no way is associated with the so-called Queen of Heaven, this idol that we see in Jeremiah 44. No connection.
All right. Thank you,
Pastor. Let me give you another little tidbit. This would be good for you to think about. A common argument that is used by Jehovah's Witnesses against celebrating birthdays is that the only time you see birthdays mentioned in the Bible, it's somebody bad, like King Herod celebrating his birthday. Or in the Old Testament, the celebration of birthdays were associated with evil people. And so they make the incorrect assumption or inference that because in the Bible you see an example of a birthday celebrated by somebody who is wicked, therefore you can't celebrate birthdays. So it's an illogical conclusion. It's a non sequitur. And the same would apply in this case. It's a non sequitur to say that just because there was an idol who is referred to by those pagans over there as the Queen of Heaven doesn't in any way diminish the fact that the Bible reveals Mary to be the Queen of Heaven in Revelation 12. You see the connection or the parallel?
Yes, yes, I understand that. I like that. But thank you for your time, and I appreciate your input and your intelligence. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that, David. Kind of you. 888-914-9149. There's time, not much time, but there's time if you want to call. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Jane now in Los Angeles. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is it permissible to move, not to move your location, well, yes, to go from one diocese to another, or maybe even to another country to seek out confirmation at a time that your own diocese is not offering it? Of like your age,
for example. Yeah, I've seen this done before where people in Southern California, they'll go to Tijuana in order to have their children confirmed because they can't for some reason get it the way they want it in the U.S. I personally don't favor that, honestly. I could see why maybe some people would feel beleaguered and they want their children to be confirmed. And maybe at the parish level, the confirmation preparation is not very good. That's possible. I've heard different reasons for people wanting to do that, or they want to go down to Tijuana because there's a more traditional mass celebrated and they would rather have their children confirmed in that. I don't think that that's, in the long run, I don't think that's a good idea. I think the better idea would be to find within your diocese, if it's a more traditional kind of issue, to find within your diocese a church where things are more traditional and see about doing it there. But ideally, we should be united with our parishes. We should be in the parish receiving the sacraments in our parish. And so I would try to do everything possible to make sure that it happened that way. And if it was simply impossible, then I would look for alternatives. But it's never sat well with me when I hear about people who are crossing the border to get their children confirmed down there because they don't like the way it's done up here. I mean, if the sacrament is valid, then all of the graces apply. They're not getting any more grace by going to Tijuana and getting their child confirmed there because it's more traditional. There's no more spiritual benefit in any way to the child because the sacrament is plenary in its effect. It's either valid or invalid. And if it's valid, it is plenary and it produces all those effects in the person receiving the sacrament. So that would be my advice.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Thanks, Jane. And no offense to any of my friends, some of whom listen to the program, who have done that. Okay. I'm not suggesting otherwise, and I'm not calling anyone's judgment into question. It's just that I personally think that we should be very circumspect about those kind of temptations and seek at all possible, if at all possible, to be united in our parish churches, if at all possible. Let's go now to, where are we going to go? Let's go to Ken in Joliet, Illinois. Hi, Ken. Hello, Ken.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Hi, Patrick. I wanted to ask you a question. I've been a convert to the Catholic faith for about 20 years.
Wonderful.
There's always been a question that's perplexed me, and perhaps you can shed some light on it for me.
I'll try.
I've asked several priests, and they don't understand it. Why is it, with all the information available, all the resources regarding the early church fathers and that type of thing, why haven't Protestant theologians and scholars and such, I'm not talking about the rank and file, but those types, come to the Catholic Church and understand that that is the true church that Christ intended?
I don't know if there's any one answer to that, Ken, because everybody is different. So I'll offer you a few thoughts that might explain it in some cases. Sometimes it could be because the person has been so conditioned to look askance at the Catholic Church, keeping in mind that this is the essence of Protestantism as such, as a phenomenon. It was a protest movement. It was a rebellion movement against the Catholic Church. And so for these past 500 years, those who are in some way a kind of historic version of the various Protestant denominations, they have been soaking in, they've been marinating in the mindset of protest against the Catholic Church. And so without even realizing it, many Protestant folk whom I've met over the years, they have an antipathy toward the Catholic Church just because it's the Catholic Church. And I remember talking to a Baptist minister once. He actually converted and became a Catholic, but he was sharing how when he was a Baptist minister and he was starting on the journey of thinking about becoming Catholic, he would notice that he couldn't, or really he found out the hard way, that he couldn't preach from the Bible on any passages that involved Mary because it made his congregation very unhappy. If he was preaching a sermon and talking about Mary, and Mary did this and Mary did that, they had a reflexive antipathy against this because that's what Catholics do. And they talk about Mary. And he would say, but I'm just quoting the Bible. I'm just saying what the Bible says. And we're talking about what the Bible says. And it was just really irksome to his congregation. Now, I don't know if that's something that would be replicated widely in the Protestant world. I suspect it might be. But the main thing is that could be one explanation to answer your question, because they've become so conditioned that for them, it's just a reflexive attitude of negativity toward the Catholic Church. That's possible. Another possibility is because in the case of, let's say, somebody who's established in the community, and this is true often with Protestant ministers, what are you going to do if you decide to become Catholic? You're out of a job now. It might mean the dissolution of your marriage. Your Protestant wife might say, I'm not going to be married to a Catholic. And if you become Catholic, I'm not going to stay with you, or I'm going to leave you and take the kids. You could lose your standing in the community. You could lose your livelihood. There are a lot of emoluments in this life that are attached to, in some cases, somebody's identity as a Protestant. Now, this is also true of Catholics. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that it can't be true of any given person. But in the case of some Protestant people I have known, I seemed to feel that maybe there was too much to sacrifice to become a Catholic. It could also be that if I become a Catholic, then it turns out that I was wrong and I don't want to be wrong. Maybe there could be a pride issue. And I think for many of them, it's none of the above. It's actually just they genuinely do believe what they believe, and they genuinely are not impressed or persuaded by the case for the Catholic Church, largely, I would say, because they've never heard it. And even to the extent that they have heard it, I think in some cases it just doesn't click and they just don't believe that. Now, what are the reasons for that? Only God knows. But that's what I'm saying. I don't think there's any one answer. There can be many different forms that would cause somebody to say, I just can't, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. Each person uniquely. So what we should do is do our very best to explain and share the Catholic faith in all of its beauty. And like Jesus says, maybe this is the best way to answer your question, Ken. Jesus himself says that the sower of the seed, he's scattering the seed all over the place. It's good seed. It's going to grow if it gets on the right soil, but some of the soil is shallow and it can't sink down roots. Some of it is rocky. Some of it gets choked by weeds. Some of it gets eaten by birds. Some of it gets trampled underfoot. And some of it falls on good, rich, deep soil where it can sink down roots and can thrive and it can grow abundantly. So I think that's the answer to your question. It leaves open the question mark, well, why is some soil shallow? Why is some soil rocky? Why is some soil trampled? Only God knows. But some soil is good and deep and rich. And so our job is to scatter the seed, so to speak, and preach the truth, preach the gospel, tell everybody the good news. And for those who are willing to accept it, they accept it. And those who don't, well, that's a mystery that only God knows the answer to.
Well, thank you very much, Patrick. Your answer is probably more satisfying than anything else I've heard. And I just want to say that the reason I'm asking this question is because my Protestant background probably goes back to the Pilgrim era. So therefore, I've been trying to speak to my brothers and those family members. I'm the only Catholic, by the way. And I try to speak to them. I sent them the book, Surprised by Truth, and things like that. And I send them Catholic documents that I find online, such as that. And it's, nothing's had any effect. And that's why I'm kind of perplexed.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they live in an area where Relevant Radio has a station, but by all means, I would suggest maybe texting them a link to the Relevant Radio app, and they could put it on their phone and just say, hey, you know, I listen to this guy on the radio. He gets into a lot of God topics, and it's fascinating. I find it interesting. And here's a link. Maybe you'd like to check it out. And chances are they'll at least give it a listen. And who knows, maybe I can hook them. We'll see. And if
sure,
I do,
I'll be glad to give that a try.
Yeah, couldn't hurt, right?
Right.
All right,
I've
Ken.
I've exhausted all other resources, but thank you very much, and I appreciate what you do every day.
Thanks, Ken. Thank you. Appreciate that. And as I mentioned for everybody listening right now, if you're thinking about Protestantism as if it were this one monolithic block of people who believe all the same thing, that's not Protestantism. Protestantism has a great variety and many different variations on a theme, keeping in mind that they have a common pedigree going back to the time of Martin Luther, when the first three major branches of the Protestant Reformation, or rebellion as it really was, began to get going in earnest. You saw the Lutheran, the Calvinist, and the Anabaptist branches. But from those three primary sources, you might say, all the other groups and subgroups and sub-subgroups, they all fragmented and broke away, but they do have a kind of common ancestry. And among the particulars, among the hallmarks of that common ancestry would be a rebellion or a rejection or a protest against the Catholic Church. That's one thing that tends to be a common thread that runs through all these various denominations, even if they disagree wildly with each other about what the Bible says. So if you're looking for a book that will calmly, in an ironic, pleasant way, kind of explain what is this phenomenon of Protestantism? What is it? And how do we understand it? I would recommend a book called The Spirit and Forms of Protestantism by the late, great Louis Bouyer, B-O-U-Y-E-R. The Spirit and Forms of Protestantism. It's a really helpful analysis of this phenomenon. So if you as a Catholic are saying, I really don't even know what that is all about, this book will help you. We're going to take a break. The number is 888-914-9149. We're going to come right back with more, including your phone calls, right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Uno, dos. dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday.
Coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day. The best for last, Cyrus.
Yeah, Young Thomas in here is, he's bumping his head. He's enjoying this.
He's tapping his toes to the beat.
Yes, that's true.
Hey, what do you make of this, Cyrus? This is out of Australia. The Australian government now says that the risk of myocarditis from a COVID booster might be greater risk than the COVID itself. So the government is now saying it's not going to allow people under 30 to get the booster.
Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Say again?
In males aged 16 to 40 years, it is uncertain whether the risk following COVID-19 remains higher than the risk following the vaccination, the government said. The government considers myocarditis and pericarditis following COVID vaccination severe enough to warrant a 13-page guideline. The guideline is updated regularly. You can find it on the Government of Australia's website. The majority of cases of myocarditis reported after COVID-19 vaccines have occurred in males under 40, and the majority have occurred within 1 to 5 days, median 2 days, following the second dose of an mRNA vaccine. Myopericarditis is more common after the second dose of Moderna compared with the second doses of Pfizer and AstraZeneca. Whoa. The guidance further states that there are no studies on the long-term dangers of myocarditis following COVID vaccination. I don't think that's true. I think there are some. Last week, Pfizer and Moderna launched clinical trials to study the long-term effects of myocarditis following vaccination with its mRNA vaccines. The launch comes roughly 18 months after the products went to market.
Right.
With the promise, with the promise of being, quote, safe and effective. Now, there's a ton more in here. NBC News reports that the Food and Drug Administration here in these United States required the drug makers to conduct the study. It was needed as part of the emergency use approval process that allowed the drugs to go to market before clinical trials were completed. And there's more in here, but this is quite a different tune from what we were hearing 18 months ago, isn't it?
I'll say, and here in the United States, they're pushing this on infants, and they want to add it to the staple of vaccinations that children get so they can go to public school. And those vaccinations are good. But this particular one,
Here's my question. Yeah, here's my question. What's the deal with all these young athletes in the prime of their life dropping dead? Hardly a day goes by, not even a day goes by, that some, you know, peak perfection young person, and often they're athletes, soccer players, and others, they just keel over dead.
I don't remember that
happening in the numbers that we're seeing now.
Me neither. You know, you'd see maybe every once in a while there'd be some family guy in his 30s or his 40s that has like instant death syndrome. They're like, I'm not sure what caused this. Now we're seeing this in kids that are playing sports, and there's multiple videos online of these kids just falling over dead.
It's a daily occurrence. You know, I almost hate to look at the headlines every morning when I'm doing my show prep, but day after day, there's yet another person just who died. It wasn't that long ago, maybe 6 months ago or so, I tweeted or I retweeted, I forget which, the story of a young, fit cardiologist who died in his sleep. And I think he was probably no more than 40 years old, maybe younger than that. But he had made a big point on social media blasting people for saying that they had concerns and qualms about the vaccine. And he said something like, I'll have to look for it, but something like, I won't shed any tears for all those people who die because they wouldn't get the vaccine. And then he got all vaccined up, and then he died suddenly in the prime of his life.
That's terrible. I mean, it's terrible to wish that on anybody who thinks differently than you do.
There was another person that this just happened in the last week or so, and I'm just blanking. I can remember it if I think about it long enough. But saying another one of these guys, kind of a public figure, who said something like, "This will prove to all of you people who are against the vaccine that there's nothing wrong with it. If I die, then you're right. But if I live, then you're clearly wrong." And then he died.
Wow!
Suddenly, young guy, prime of his life, and he died. So, Could it just be a coincidence? That the likelihood of that seems so remote as to be,
I mean,
impossible.
I love a good conspiracy, but this sure seems like a multi-billion-dollar marketing effort from Big Pharma to literally use scare tactics to get everyone behind getting a vaccine that wasn't tested at all, and it got to the point where the doctors wouldn't see a sick person, like someone that's legitimately sick, because they chose not to get this untested vaccination.
I remember.
And over and over and over again. And now here we're on the other side of it, just like we talked about.
But if you publicly ask the question, why are all these young people dying? Why are all these young, fit, physically, in great shape, young people just dying? You're not allowed to ask that question. So I'm asking that question. I don't know.
Keep asking it, please, because I need to know the answer to this.
Don't we all? Well, isn't it interesting how life has changed so dramatically from what we were hearing 18 months ago? Anyway, let's go to Martin now in Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning. Let me, I guess, turn off my radio.
That'd be good. That would be great.
Oh, okay. Now, I understand that if a Catholic doesn't get married in a Catholic church, that he's living in sin. Is that true?
If a Catholic doesn't get married in the Catholic Church without permission from the bishop, then the church regards that as an invalid marriage. So for him or her to be validly married, the requirement is to be married in the church in the presence of an official witness of the church, which would be typically a priest. Could also be a deacon, could also be a bishop. So that's a requirement for the validity of marriage. Now, that doesn't apply to non-Catholics, but it does apply to Catholics.
Well, how did that come about? I mean, maybe is that the 11th commandment? Who made that rule, and how did it get made?
That was a rule that was made by the bishops of the church. And if you wanted a kind of a canon law explanation of the history of it, I would recommend a canon law blog by Ed Peters. He takes that up in detail. And also Kathy Caridi, who's another canon lawyer I'm familiar with, she has a blog. It's called Canon Law Made Easy. And she, too, has talked about that issue. So if you want kind of an extended historical analysis, they can give that to you. But it's part of what Jesus himself said to the apostles in Matthew chapter 16. He said this to Peter individually. And in Matthew chapter 18, he said it to all the apostles. Whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. And so this authority to bind and loose certain things that are required of the faithful, the church has that authority given to it by Christ. So this would be an example of how that's being exercised.
But, you know, the government of the United States recognizes the church's authority to marry people, mm-hmm. and yet there's no reciprocality between the church and the civil law. And and the other thing is, do you think the people, the parishioners would agree with that? I mean, have they ever been asked or have they voted on it? I mean, it seems like all these laws are coming from the cardinals or the bishops, and the lay people have very little or actually nothing to say about it.
Well, we do, but remember, Martin, that the Catholic Church is not a democracy. It wasn't founded or established by Jesus as
a
democracy.
That's true.
We're not congregationalists. We don't vote on what we want in our parish. We're led by the Good Shepherd, and Jesus established his church in such a way that the shepherds of the church are the ones who lead in that direction. Remember, too, that in Matthew 28, Jesus said to the same apostles, teach them to observe all that I have commanded you. And so there are certain things in the church's law that are not necessarily coming from Jesus himself, but it's a way to provide for the greatest benefit for the greatest number of people. Now, one thing to remember is that in the Catholic Church, marriage between two baptized parties is a sacrament. So it's not just a civil union recognized by the civil law. It is that. But it's more than that. It's also a sacrament. And so because the church has the custody, you might say, of the sacraments and how they're celebrated, the church has a right to determine how the sacraments will be celebrated. So I don't feel the least bit bothered that I didn't have a say in that.
I would like to see more participation by the lay people in terms of governance and policies and procedures of the church. It seems that we're left out. And, you know, if I buy 1,000 shares of IBM stock, then I get every year a proxy vote to vote for the board members and so on. And I don't see much, or actually any of it, in the Catholic Church. I think that's wrong.
Well, it's too bad you feel that way, Martin, because that's the way Jesus established it. And regardless of how you feel, the church is not a democracy, and you don't have a vote.
This is not
a publicly traded corporation. This is a church established by Jesus, and it's arranged the way he himself set it up. Now, if you don't like how Jesus did it, really, he's the one you should be having the argument with.
But did he say anything about not being allowed to be married outside the church? I think, you know, we take the Ten Commandments and add a lot more than what Jesus said.
Well, I already gave you three verses where Jesus did say that. He did say Matthew 16, Matthew 18, and then by extension, Matthew 28. First of all, to whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. So there's an authority to determine what is permitted and not permitted. And in Matthew 28, once again, Jesus said to the apostles, teach them all that I have commanded you. So they have a teaching office with authority from Jesus. I'll add a fourth verse, Luke 10:16. Jesus said to these same men, whoever listens to you, listens to me. Whoever rejects you, rejects me. So I realize that if it doesn't sit well with you, okay, fair enough. But if you reject the voice of Jesus speaking through the magisterium of the church, the problem is you're rejecting Jesus, because he empowered the magisterium of the church to preach and teach in his name.
Well, it's interesting, you know, how this is. I mean, the Ten Commandments say thou shalt not commit adultery, but the Catholic Church has extended that to but intimacy between adults that are not married to each other. And I don't know how that came about. It just seems like these rules are made by old men who are not... Hello?
Martin, I'm not sure where you're going with that, but you're still on the air.
Yeah.
Do you observe the rules of the road when you're driving?
Oh, yes.
Well, those rules are made by old men, typically men. Those rules are human in origin. Now, the ones we're talking about in the Catholic Church are not necessarily human in origin. But why do you accept the rules when you're out in the car driving that were written by old men?
Well, I'd get a speeding or get a ticket if I didn't. So I have no choice.
Well, but isn't it fair to say that those rules by those old men are there for a good reason? And they help keep people alive, like stop signs and intersections and crosswalks and speed limits. I mean, if we didn't have those rules, life would be pretty miserable, wouldn't it? And in the same way, the church in her governance is wise in recognizing that there are certain requirements, certain some privileges, some duties that we all have to live by. The church is a family, and we all have to look out for each other.
Well, that's true.
And this is an example of where the rule is wise. It's not capricious, you know. It's not
well,
tyrannical.
That's true. And it's true, but I think that the parishioners should have more of a say in a church. And do you think that the church is ever going to move in that direction?
I don't think in the way that maybe you're thinking of it, that it might. I mean, there have been times in the history of the church where lay people were consulted when somebody would be named a bishop, for example. That's been done before. But what would happen, though, Martin? Let's say that if at your parish, let's say that 85% of everybody voted and said, we want to keep the church the way it is, and 15% voted and said, we want to change things. Would that really matter one way or the other? In other
well,
words, would
you have to change it? Or, I don't know. If the majority say to leave it the way it is, then it should be left the way it is. But I can't imagine people giving up their rights to vote on policies and procedures and you know, more of a democratic organization. It's not just a bunch of old men sitting in Rome making up rules. They don't have the diversity or the experience of some of the younger people and different cultures, and I think it should be more democratic.
I understand. Well, we disagree on that point only because, as I said earlier, the church is not a democracy. The church is not, we're not congregationalists, and we don't vote for things like that. Jesus is the one who established the church, and he's the one who made it the way it is. I think I would rather try to come to Jesus on his terms than demand that he come to me on my terms.
Well, yes, that's true. But anyway, well, I think I'm taking too much of your time.
No, it's okay. But we ran out of time. Interesting conversation, though, Martin. I appreciate your time. I hope you'll call me back another time. And for now, I'll have to leave it at that. My apologies to those of you who are holding. Please pray for me. I'll pray for you. God bless you.